11 this afternoon, if you want to be working your way over there. And this is another one of those spots where you don't have a really, really good chapter break to find a stopping point. 11 runs into 12 as far as an ongoing theme, so we'll see how far we can get, and hopefully we can stop at a reasonable point. If not, we'll need to kind of maybe backtrack a little bit next week to pick up some context. But in particular, beginning in verse 9 of chapter 11, from there through chapter 8 of verse 12 is something of a clear section in itself, and then 9 through the end of the chapter, of chapter 12 through the end of the book, is a final section. 11, 1 through 6 is its own section, and then 7 and 8 is a little bit of an oddity there, but that's kind of what we'll be working our way through. We'll spend a fair amount of time in verses 1 through 6, because this is a relatively familiar passage in Ecclesiastes, and there are a couple of ways of looking at it, and we'll talk through both of those. So that's where we'll begin and see how far we can get today. Let's begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for all the blessings that you've given us, for all of the good things that you do for us and fill our lives with, and we ask that as we have received from your hand so freely, that we would give so freely as well. That as we have opportunity and we have people in our lives who are in need, that we would provide in whatever way we can, even beyond what we are able to do, as you have done so abundantly for us. Help us as we study that we would be open to your word and to what it has to show us. In your Son we pray. Amen. All right, chapter 11, verses 1 through 6. I'll go ahead and read it first and then kind of give you the two basic ways that this text is approached and kind of some of the nuts and bolts of how that works itself out through these verses. And then we can discuss that as there is a desire to have discussion. Beginning in verse 1, "Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. If a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the way, the spirit comes to the bones of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand, for you do not know what will prosper, this or that, and whether both alike will be good." All right, a couple of options here. Some people see this as just kind of wisdom of how to live your life in terms of, what we might call a business venture, how to manage your money, how to conduct yourself in that kind of regard. Others see this as focusing primarily on the issue of philanthropy and benevolence, of giving to other people as other people are in need. And it really is in verses 1 and 2 where you kind of see how both approaches can be taken, and then the rest of it kind of follows naturally in terms of either one. So, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. If bread is bread, if it's food, this is a way of saying give as you have opportunity. You cast it out there and it will come back to you. You take kind of the New Testament idea of with what measure you give, it will be given back to you. Cast your bread upon the waters and you will find it after many days is the idea. And so verse 2 then is give a portion to 7 or even to 8. Share with many, don't hoard up for yourself. Give to as many people as you have opportunity to give to would be the idea there in verse 2. It's a little bit more complicated if you look at it the other way, and that's not to say that it's necessarily a bad approach. It's just more metaphorical in terms of a lot of what's going on. Here, bread is your resources, not literally bread necessarily. And what it refers to is the fact that there's a lot of business conducted in the ancient world by sea. You go down to the sea, you go down to a port town, and you invest in something. You're casting your bread upon the waters, and it's going to be a while before you get anything back from it. With that kind of trade, with that kind of business, especially in the ancient world, where not only did it take a very long time for that sort of thing to happen, but you had no way of knowing what was going on while it was going on. I mean, you couldn't, you know, check your smartphone and link into a satellite and see where the ship is or anything like that. You know, has it made it over to India yet to get those spices? Well, who knows what's going on with that at that point. And so there's this element of trust in ancient business. Ships are going to be very long delayed very often before there's any profit one way or the other. But you've got to commit yourself to that if you're ever going to have any hope of success in that kind of business venture. If you don't commit to it, then there's no hope whatsoever of doing that. So in spite of the risks of loss, you should go ahead and engage in this sort of thing, because after all, guarantees very rarely exist in life, and there's greater folly in doing nothing than in prudently living life with its risks and uncertainties. And there then becomes, I think, something of a principle that extends beyond just business ventures, that there's more folly in doing nothing than there is in prudently living your life with its risks and its uncertainties. But there's trust in this kind of life. There's total commitment that is demanded in this kind of life. There's the need to look forward rather than to focus on the present or the past in this kind of life. And it has a reward that requires patience as you go through it, and that's kind of all summed up in cast your bread on the waters, and you will find it after many days. Now, verse 2 then, instead of giving of your means to 7 or 8 as people are in need, this is to, what we would say is diversify your portfolio. That's how we would say it in our language. Be zealous in your business, be widespread in your investments, so to speak, because you don't know what's going to happen. You diversify your financial risks, and then if one or two go under, there are, you know, 6 or 7 left out there to make it through, and you'll be fine in that regard. So those are kind of the two ways that this is looked at. I don't necessarily know that one is more literal than the other. And of course, literalness isn't the hallmark of good biblical interpretation anyway. But those are kind of the two approaches and how they play themselves out in the first couple of verses. And then, like I say, after you kind of get to establish the way you want to look at the overall theme, the rest of the verses flow a little bit more naturally from that point forward. Charlie? Jonathan?
My first thought was, did he just suddenly and dramatically change topics in the previous section? It was all about, you know, dealing with foolish rulers and problems with that, and then suddenly he switched to investment advice, no transition, or something of that sort.
Well, there is a big 11 on the page there to mark the change.
I guess it's good that he was smart enough for the chapter.
That's right, that's right. What do you mean those were added thousands of years later? Mm-hmm.
That seems like that's a really, whatever he's saying here is that it's in light of all that, is how much uncertainty we experience in this life, which fits in with his message earlier in the book. And so
Yeah, and so in that way of thinking about it, it's not to be seen as specifically either charitable giving or, you know, financial risks and business venture. It would be true of both of those, but right. True of those and more, it's more of a principle being established there. I think that's a helpful way of looking at it. And like you say, this theme of you don't know runs through this section. In verses 3 and 4, and we'll talk more about these verses in a second, that's kind of your illustration of not knowing. I mean, there's something to know about if the clouds are full of rain, they're going to empty themselves. I mean, you know that that's going to happen, but you don't necessarily know when it's going to happen. There's a little bit of time to plan ahead as you see the storm blowing up, but especially in the ancient world, you know, where they couldn't flip on the weather channel and get a, depending on where you live, reasonably accurate forecast. You don't know that's coming until it's really too late. And so there are difficulties of life kind of enumerated and illustrated in verses 3 and 4 that go with that idea of you don't know, even though that phrase isn't specifically show up there. What else here in the first couple of verses? Well, let's look at verses 3 and 4 then a little bit more closely. Basically, the idea is things are going to do as they will, and you can't control them. Accidents often happen, and outcomes are often dependent on factors that are outside your control. But you still need to act in spite of the fact that these kinds of things are going on. There is what is, you know, sometimes called, verse 4, he observes that the wind will not sow, he who regards the clouds will not reap. If you're sitting there waiting for the perfect time to do something, whatever it may be, whether it's planting like is given in the illustration here or whatever else, if you wait for the perfect moment, you're probably never going to do anything because that perfect moment just doesn't come. This is, you know, again, in our lingo, he who hesitates is lost, is the idea there. It's what has been called the paralysis of analysis, which is a nice little turn of phrase. But it's you get stuck thinking and reasoning instead of doing, and nothing ever happens there. But notice, again, in these two analogies, you got clouds that are full of rain. If the clouds are full of rain, they're going to empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, where it falls, that's where it's going to fall. Now, what are some differences or similarities in these two different issues that come up in life? You know, the clouds are full of rain, they're going to rain. That's going to be a problem for you if you're trying to do something. The tree's going to fall over. It's going to fall over when it does. And where it falls over, that's where it's going to fall over. Those two analogies aren't exactly the same. There's similarities to them. Is there anything in particular that you notice about these two analogies, Greg? Okay, so in terms of similarities, you don't have control over these things. They're going to happen when they happen and how they happen, and you've got to live with it. You've got to deal with it. You've got to, you know, soldier on through it or whatever you might say there. Charlie?
With the clouds, you have a reasonable short period of time to prepare for it.
Okay.
When a tree falls, sometimes you have mere seconds.
Okay. So, yeah, a difference between the two is you have, I mean, both of them, again, they can happen relatively quickly, but you can have a little bit more time to prepare for a storm than you do for a tree falling, usually. Of course, there are, you know, exceptions to both, but generally speaking, there are some difference in the way you have to prepare for them. Stephen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see verse 3 as an explanation of the latter part of verse 2.
Mm-hmm.
You do not know what evil will be on the earth. But of course, the word evil, they have different.
Right.
Unusual circumstances or whatever, like the clouds full of rain, the tree falls, etc. Seems to be there's a connection.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's right. I think this is building off of the end of verse 2 and connected back to it.
And as much as we don't like getting wet, it seems like, at least in a lot of cases, rain is a positive thing. Rain is good. That's how your food grows. You start without rain. Whereas trees falling, I don't think, are generally distinction between the not so predictable good thing and the not so predictable bad thing?
Possibly. I think as Guy was saying, this is kind of elaborating on the bad things that will happen on the earth. And then into verse 4, he who observes the wind will not sow. These are things, I think, that are hindering your progress at whatever you're trying to accomplish. But I think there is still something to be said for the fact that one of these, at least, can be seen as a blessing, at least more clearly than the other one can. So there, yeah. Well, I mean, it's always needed. Sometimes we may need a little bit less of it than other times, but it's different from a tree.
Adjective full. I was just watching the news. There are floods in the western part of the country, and the clouds are full of grain. It may be too much.
Yeah. One other thing that I think is perhaps something of a distinction between them is that one of them seems more inevitable. I mean, trees falling down are inevitable as well, but you don't just walk around thinking, oh, I bet all these trees are going to fall down one day. I mean, you don't think of trees falling down as an inevitability, although it really is. I mean, when you see clouds building up and you see rain off in the distance and it's blowing your way, I mean, there is some small chance that it might miss you, but what everyone says is it's going to rain today. Rain out of full clouds is an inevitability, and trees falling down is more of a randomness. Now, I don't know let me say this a different way. I am quite certain that this does not exhaust the illustrations here, but there's something else, as far as it goes. And you add in the erratic wind of verse 4 as well. You got wind and weather and rain and the danger of falling trees. The point of all of it is you can't sit around and wait for all of that to pass before you do something. You need to act when you have the opportunity to act. That seems to be the clear point of all of this. Whether it's a business venture or a charity or a general principle that includes those things and more, the point is act as you have opportunity to act. There are going to be things that try to get in your way and stop you from doing the things you need to do. Don't let those things distract you from what you need to do. Do those things anyway. Yes, ma'am. Are you done? Yeah, so there's not only the repercussions of getting wet from the rain or, getting smashed by a tree, and not just the paralysis of thinking about it and trying to figure it out and wait for the proper moment, there's also the reality of the emotional reaction of fear as you see these things coming. And sometimes that may be the initial driving force of sitting there thinking about it and being paralyzed by the reasoning and the thought process is you're afraid of what is going to happen if you sow at the wrong time or if you reap at the wrong time or if you invest at the wrong time or whatever it may be, is that fear being kind of the origin point of that. Charlie?
I was also thinking of the repercussions of what you said. Rain falls on the many. Trees fall on
And I think ultimately what the point of a lot of this is because of the uncertainties, because of the unknowns, because of the dangers, you must act when you have the opportunity. And it's kind of, flies in the face of what might be our natural reaction, where the fear begins and the analysis begins and trying to figure out the perfect moment begins, leads you to not do anything. What he's saying is because you don't know what's going to happen, that's precisely why you need to get out there and do something now. Because if you don't, nothing is ever going to happen, good or bad, and you're not going to get anywhere in life. Joy?
Yeah,
Yes. Yeah, the farmer who waits for the perfect weather is never going to plant. You know, the person who waits, you know, one of the things that you probably have heard or at some point will hear, depending on where you are in life, is if you wait for the perfect moment to start your family, to have children, you're never going to have children, because that perfect moment where everything is however you imagine it in your head as the perfect moment is never going to happen. And there are so many cases of that, whether it's that or any other number of things. If you wait for that perfect moment, whatever you have fantasized as the perfect moment to be, nothing's going to happen. So you need to get out there and do what you know you need to do as you have the opportunity to do it. Is kind of another way of getting to this point. Now, verse 5 gets into more of these kinds of unknowns and further illustrates the idea of the fact that there's just so much we don't know, that we don't understand, that there are aspects of God's working that defy our explanation. And it's a reminder that living a life of faith and living a life of action is not something that is because there is no ignorance. It is in spite of the ignorance that we have. Faith does not remove the problem of ignorance. It enables us to live with the ignorance that we have because we're trusting in God rather than trusting in our ability to come up with all the answers. We act when we have those occasions. And so verse 6 then, kind of on the basis of the uncertainty of life, which is what's been running through so much of this section, therefore, he doesn't say therefore, but that's the idea, therefore in the morning sow your seed. And at evening, withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. You don't know what's going to happen. And there are lots of dangerous things like storms and wind and falling trees. So what you need to do in the morning, go plant. And in the evening, go give. And you don't know what any of it's going to turn out to be, but that's still what you need to do. Guarantees just aren't possible. I mean, wisdom can maximize the chance for success, of course. Inaction and folly will inevitably lead to failure. And so our best approach, he says, is to give ourselves to the responsibilities at hand, to await the course of events, to see where they go. And so these uncertainties of life that we've been working through here is what he says is it should not be a hindrance to action, it should be a motivation to act. Is really what it all works itself out to in terms of the final analysis. Adam, are you going to say something?
Yeah, I just noticed that first part of verse 6 really parallels verses 1 and 2. So in the morning, sow your seed, and then in the evening, cast your bread upon the waters. At evening, withhold not your hand, and and this reminds me kind of the Proverbs where the emphasis is on being productive and not being sluggard. And so you don't know what's going to happen. Don't just do the minimum. Get out and work hard, and then also be generous. You know, just realize you don't know everything that's going to occur, but still on the side of being productive and also being generous at the same time.
Right, and I mean, where was it we came across? Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. I mean, that principle would fit into this idea as well here, and we ran across that already.
Second, verses 4 and 5, it looks like those statements are put together, that keyword spirit or wind is the same word. Maybe leads them to say, you know, speaking of that, you don't know which way the wind blows, you also don't know how the spirit goes.
Yeah, that's a good connection. I didn't make that. Yeah, so if you didn't catch that, and for the sake of anyone who is a glutton for punishment and listens to the recordings of my class, and if that didn't pick up, the Hebrew word for wind in verse 4 and the word spirit in verse 5 is the same word, and so there may be some connection between verses 4 and 5. You know, you don't know what the wind is going to do the same way in a much bigger sense. You don't know the way the spirit comes to the... Yes. Yeah, to Nicodemus and the wind and the spirit both in that context as well. It's another good connection. Anything else here in the first six verses? Yeah, Greg?
same ideas mirrored in the New Testament, to continue working, and that if we don't grow weary, then we're going to read.
Anything else here? All right, verses 7 and 8 are something of a lead-in to the end of the section, or the end of the book, I should say. It doesn't parallel as closely verses 9 and following, but it does introduce us to a couple of themes that we're going to see a lot in verses 9 and following. So light is sweet, and it's a pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. So you've got a couple of ideas here in verses 7 and 8. And it seems that the two main ideas in verses 7 and 8 are life and death, which were, you know, huge ongoing themes throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. We've seen life and death basically all the way through being discussed. Now, it's shocking in a sense for him to say light is sweet and it's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun, when his opening statement is vanity of vanities, all is vanity, and his closing statement is vanity of vanities, all is vanity, in terms of what the preacher himself says. Now, it seems that there's going to be a different wisdom teacher who concludes the book. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But what the preacher begins and ends with is this vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And he has said over and over and over, you look for meaning and happiness and satisfaction in this? That's vanity. You look for meaning and happiness and satisfaction in this? Well, that's vanity too. And this over that? Well, that's vanity too. And this looks like it might provide some satisfaction, but yeah, you're just going to die. And so that's vanity too. And I mean, that's kind of been the ongoing thrust of the book all the way through, is just the reality of death. And so for him to say light is sweet and it's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun is, in a sense, surprising. Yet at the same time, we've also seen him say over and over and over, enjoy life while you can. Enjoy the simple blessings while you can. Don't look to these things to find ultimate meaning in life, but you can look to these things to find some satisfaction in life as you live it. It's a gift from God if you enjoy it as a gift from God, and don't look at it as a God itself, basically, is what it amounts to. And so it's a little surprising, perhaps, but at the same time, we have seen this kind of idea that you can enjoy life in the right context. And life is better than death. He said that before a time or two as well. And so it's not completely unprecedented in the book for him to say these kinds of things. Now, the two things that do come up here that we're going to run into a whole lot in verses 9 and following are in verse 8. Let him, one, rejoice in them all, and two, let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. Remembering is something that's going to come up a few times, and rejoicing is going to come up a few times as well. And so this is beginning to get some of these ideas into our mind that we're going to encounter as we continue on in the end of chapter 11 and in chapter 12. Now, death specifically is never named in this, but it is, when he says the days of darkness will be many, I don't think he means you die and then it's dark. As he's going to continue on, the days of darkness are the days of old age, it seems, in chapter 12. But that is going to be directly connected and leads to death at the end of that section in chapter 12 as well. And so it's the bad times of life that conclude with death is the days of darkness, at least as I see it in connection to what we're going to see in the beginning of chapter 12. All right, thoughts here in verse 7 and 8. Guy, did you have your hand up? Right. Right. And he's going to say, notice in chapter 12 and verse 1, to kind of give you the idea of where I'm going with this. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. And then it goes on to describe old age, basically is what it's describing. It's a very poetic, figurative description of old age. We'll see how that works itself out when we get to that section of the text, but it's a description of old age leading to death. And that's begun with the evil days, when the sun and light and moon are all darkened and the clouds return after the rain. So I think that's the connection to the days of darkness here. Enjoy life while you can, because the days of darkness, the bad days, are going to be many. Brian, do you have your hand up?
Yes. Verse 8, different way of stating in chapter 3, there's a time, there's good and bad in life, you know, there's a time to weep, time to laugh, time to mourn, and time to dance.
Yeah. Enjoy your years while you can, because that's the good times, and there are also going to be bad times. Jonathan? Yeah, I think so. And verses 7 and 8 are really kind of a bridge between the two sections. And it connects perhaps not as strongly to verses 1 through 6, but it does. It ties in with those ideas, like you're saying. But then also it gives us a more direct lead into, I mean, the days of darkness will be many, all that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. This is where you go from here. Rejoice in your youth. Remove vexation from your heart. Remember your Creator are going to be kind of the three big imperatives there. Greg?
I was just thinking, I understand where you're going with the days of darkness being sort of a poetic way of aging. It's written to a young man. Okay, you're going to wake up, see the light of day, you're energetic, you're ready to go. There's going to be dark days also. You're going to have days filled with light and days filled with darkness even before you get up.
Yeah, that's true. And so perhaps it's good days and bad days. Days of darkness are the bad days, and there's going to be many of those regardless. But there's going to be more as you get older, I think.
And it may even literally refer to the dimming of the eyes.
Right. And I think that's part of the imagery in chapter 12 is the dimming of the eyes and the loss of sight over time. But we'll get to all of those images when we get to all of those images. It's dangerous to get too specific with that imagery, too. Any time you're dealing with metaphors and trying to figure out what the literal aspect of the metaphor is, when it's not clearly spelled out, the only thing that really limits you is your imagination and common sense. And what does everything in chapter 12 represent? Well, maybe some of it doesn't represent anything specifically. Some of it does. We'll talk about that when we get there. Jonathan? Right, yeah, that's right. Some of it, I think, is clearer than other things. I don't want to get too much into that in chapter 12 because we still have the rest of chapter 11 to get through. But since I'm the one that opened the door on this, that's my own fault. Let's just notice a couple of things. Verse 3, in the day where the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent. This is basically a description of your body as it begins to lose some of its function over the time of age. What are the keepers of the house and the strong men? Well, all kinds of things are guessed at, but those are two of the things that seem to be a little bit more enigmatic. And, if you read four different commentaries, you're going to find four different answers. Sometimes it's the arms, sometimes it's the legs, sometimes it's, the trembling would refer to your body as, sometimes with older age, there's more of a quiver to the body. I've seen the strong men being bent, referring to the back, unable to stand up straight. I've seen it refer to the arms or the legs or the thighs specifically. And again, it's a little bit, kind of odd there. But as when you get further down, I think it's a little bit easier to notice a few things. The almond tree blossoms, it says in verse 5. This is kind of a classic one that basically everybody agrees about. Because if you've ever seen an almond tree blossom, what it does is it turns completely white on the top. And it's a reference to the graying of hair with old age. At least it almost certainly is. That's what it certainly seems to be. The grasshopper drags itself along. Well, there is a spryness in the step of a young person that's not there with the aged anymore. The one that could once just run and jump and leap all over the place is dragging itself along now. And so that's, I think, a pretty obvious image as well. And so that's the kind of thing that we're dealing with there in chapter 12 as far as the metaphorical language and the description of age. We'll look at more of those more specifically probably next time. But like I said, since I opened the door and the question came up, that's kind of what we're talking about there as we get to that description. And then I think it does become pretty clear when the silver cord is snapped and the golden bowl is broken and the pitcher is shattered at the fountain. And then you get probably the clearest specific connection. The dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. That's pretty obvious. The person has died at that point. So that's where we're going. We're going to death, which is kind of the point. That's where everybody's going eventually. All right. We'll set that aside until next time. Anything else about verses 7 and 8 before we get into this last section that, again, kind of all ties itself together very well? All right, well, let's read verse 9 through chapter 12 and verse 1. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. And then that's what's going to lead on to this discussion of life as it continues. Now what you find in a lot of these are kind of a negative, positive outlook, which really begins back in verse 7. Light is sweet and it's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun, but remember that the days of darkness are coming, in verse 8. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, but know that for all of this God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart, put away pain from your body, because youth and the dawn of life is vanity. Remember your Creator, because the evil days are coming. And so you've got kind of the positive, negative back and forth that runs through all of these. But there are, again, three basic ideas that work really well in English because they all begin with R. I don't think that's probably the case in Hebrew. I never checked to see if it's an alliteration in Hebrew or not. But rejoice, remove, and remember are our three ideas, our three R's. Of Ecclesiastes 11 and 12. So verse 11, rejoice in your youth. Enjoy your youth. Seek after those things that you enjoy as you have the opportunity to. Again, the evil days are coming is where all of this is going. So as you have the occasion in your youth to enjoy the things that life has to offer, enjoy them then, because you may not have those opportunities later on. But remember, and not just remember, know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. And knowledge here, I think, is more than just intellectual perception. It's more than just this vague idea in the back of your mind that God is going to do this. It's a firm grasp of the truth of the situation that corrects your life and molds your life into the kind of action that is consistent with that knowledge. Know that God will judge you doesn't just mean, you know, comprehend this fact intellectually. It means let this guide the decisions you make as you rejoice in your youth and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. This is not God is a colossal stick in the mud so you can't have any fun. It's let your understanding of God shape the kind of enjoyment you have and the kind of fun that you have. Would be one way of thinking about that. Second, remove vexation from your heart. Remove pain from your body. Now, vexation here is a word that's used in Ecclesiastes for the perplexity or grief or irritation that's caused by life. It's kind of the negative counterpoint to rejoicing. The way you rejoice is you remove these irritants from your life that keep you from being able to be joyful. Remove pain from your body, whatever physical barriers there are, as much as is possible. Get those things out of the way of enjoying life. And the idea, I think, is, again, while you're young, you do this while you can because youth is vanity. And here, vanity, we've talked about, you know, what does vanity mean in Ecclesiastes? And sometimes it seems to carry this idea of meaninglessness. And other times it carries the idea of something being very short-lived, very temporary, very fleeting, life is a vapor kind of thing. And that seems to be the idea here. It's not that youth is meaningless, it's that youth is brief. Youth is fleeting. Youth is a vapor, and it's gone, and you're not going to be able to enjoy these things. You're not going to be able to put pain away from your body forever. There are things that you can do when you're young, even when you hurt a little bit, that it doesn't work that way once you get older. This is a terrible illustration of it, but when I was a kid, and we were going to play something, whether it was just run around in the yard or whether we were going out to play basketball or whatever it may be, when I was a kid, I just went out and we started playing. I remember once I got into my 20s and the first time I tried to do that without stretching, how I felt the next day. That's just a very small example of how the ability to put pain away from your body changes as you get older. And if that's happening, you know, when I'm 25 back then, imagine what would happen if I'm 65 and I decide to start go running without taking care of things. You know, it took me a few days back then to get over it. What will it be like later on? And that, I think, is kind of the idea of chapter 12 and verse 2. The clouds return after the rain. The storm hit and the storm was really bad. Well, what happens? Well, the clouds regather and another storm's coming. That's the danger of old age, is that just as you think you're getting better, another storm comes. So you put these things away from you while you can. And then chapter 12 and verse 1, remember your Creator, commit yourself to God. Like when God remembers people in the Bible, it's not because He had forgotten them and He had to remember them. It's God acting on the basis of a promise that He has made to them. He's acting in covenant loyalty to them. Remember God. It's the same sort of idea there. I would suggest to commit yourself to God, to commit yourself to your covenant to God, and you remember Him in your youth, which is contradictory to how a lot of people think. What a lot of people think is sow your wild oats in your youth and turn to God at the end of your life. You know, have as much fun as you can, and then at the last second, then you turn to God and everything will be okay. Well, what the preacher is saying is, no, that's not really the best way of doing things. Because, again, where he's going is increasing age brings about inevitable decline, and things are going to get worse. You're not going to be able to rejoice in your youth, because youth is vanity. You're not going to be able to remove vexation from your heart and pain from your body, because youth is vanity. And so don't think that if you don't focus on God when you're young, that somehow you're going to come up with the ability to focus on God later on in life. Now, if you don't do it now while you're able to follow after the things that you enjoy and remove vexation and pain, what makes you think you're going to be able to turn to God when the evil days come? In youth, illness is a setback. In later years, illness is a disaster. It's in our youth that we must remember God and follow Him. The one who's not trained in their youth to remember God is going to be very ill-equipped to deal with the challenges of age. And they're not going to want to turn to God at that point in their life. If you don't focus on God at the beginning, what reason are you going to have to focus on God later on in life? Now, of course, there are exceptions to every rule. There have been a lot of people who've turned to God at the end of their life. But it begins by forming the habits of worship early, not hoping for a deathbed conversion. That's not the wise path to take. Greg. Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, that does connect us back to the ideas of act now that we saw in 11:1 through 6. Jonathan?
You kind of answered one of my questions. First, he's going all through the book telling us that life is bad and there's something you can do to avoid it. So then it seems really weird that it is. So, you know, remove vexation and pain. That's not possible.
Yeah, that is kind of, and I think that kind of goes in, I think 11:9 through 12:1 is really the same idea expressed in different ways. Rejoice in your youth, remove vexation from your body, remember your Creator. If you're looking at all of this from the proper perspective, those things fit together naturally. You can rejoice in your youth by removing vexation from your body, or pain from your body and vexation from your heart, and that leads to you naturally remembering God while you have the opportunity in your youth, is the beginning point of that. And so I think they're all tied in together, not three just random ideas that all happen to start with letter R in English. It's alliterative foreknowledge or something. All right, any other thoughts? All right, we'll stop there, and we'll pick up in 12:1 to give us a little bit of context, and we'll talk about this description of the coming of old age in 12:2 through 8, and then wrap up next week the book with this conclusion of ultimately fearing God and keeping His commandments.